Hey, everybody, this is Travis Davis, back with Author Eke today. We have a very prestigious author today who's written a book that I am thoroughly enjoying because it's close to my heart and my livelihood at one time. So, Jerome Preisler.
Yes, sir.
Yes. So, Jerome, tell us about yourself, introduce yourself, and all the books you've written. You've written a few.
Well, you got my name, and I've written a lot of books, both fiction, nonfiction, a lot of military nonfiction, as well as novels. I've also collaborated with Tom Clancy and posthumously with the Tom Clancy franchise, having written two series, but one called Net Force, which is the most recent, and one called Power Plays, which was a while back. Here I am.
Excellent, excellent. So where are you based out of?
Right now I'm in Maine. It's not a Maine accent that you're hearing. I grew up in Brooklyn and lived most of my life in New York, but I've been in Maine for a while now.
Excellent. So talk to us about this book, because this is interesting, because a lot of people have no idea what a pathfinder is or was in the military.
Yeah. And that's really in a nutshell why I wrote the book. How it came about was I'm a student of World War II, and I'd read a lot of World War II history and was aware of the pathfinders who were the tip of the spear, the airborne forces. If you're looking at, go back to World War II, and Normandy, the airborne forces landed actually the night before the invasion, and the first airborne forces troops to jump onto Normandy were the Pathfinders. And as you can kind of glean from the name, it was their job to light the paths for the subsequent waves of airborne troops to and the pilots to zero in on and find their LZs, their landing zones, or drop zones, excuse me.
Because very seldom do they ever drop where they don't know what's where they're dropping into.
Yeah, and this
and LZs are already predefined.
Yeah, and you know that's a really good point, because we have to keep in mind with the Pathfinders and when they were founded, which was during World War II, that we didn't have, satellite recon. We didn't have the kind of advanced, spy technologies that we have today, which is why it was such a chaotic jump, even with the Pathfinders. But these guys, it was really thought of as close to a suicide mission. It was obviously a volunteer group, and there were only 365 or 360 odd Pathfinders who jumped onto Normandy. And it was something like whatever it was, eight planes or something. There were no ground defenses because we hadn't touched down on enemy soil yet. So they were completely vulnerable. That's the story. They had 15 minutes in which to execute their mission, which was to lay these lighted panels in the shape of a T. And if you can picture a T laid out on the ground with the head of the T being that horizontal crossbar, and then the long bar obviously being the vertical bar of the T, that vertical bar was can be compared to almost the a landing strip. That was for the pilots to zone in on, so they could see where they were gonna as they approached the drop zones. When they got to that horizontal bar, that's when the men would jump, and you can imagine that was split second. And and if you remember, the weather that night was horrible. Pilots couldn't even orient themselves. They were flying through these stacked clouds so that visually they couldn't see anything until the last minute. And they were under fire. They were getting anti-aircraft. They were taking anti-aircraft fire. Also, yeah. The C-47s that brought our troops had to travel light, so they didn't have any armaments. They didn't even have they had no guns, and mm-hmm. so the pilots were again think of the heroism of those pilots. They had no defenses, and many of them dropped their sticks for their troopers.
Yep.
While the aircraft were on fire, so it was. It's quite a piece of history.
Yeah, and what I found out in the book I didn't know was that the idea for the Pathfinders was actually from a pilot who was a commercial pilot before he joined the Army. And that was his idea about the Pathfinder.
Yeah, this guy, and his name escapes me now, but he's in the book, and he was a visionary. And he not only came up with the idea, but even after the war, came up with all sorts of different technologies and for commercial flights. It bugs me that my name's going, his name's escaping me at the moment, but it's a good reason to read the book.
Yeah, exactly. It's a remarkable story of somebody that wouldn't jump out of the airplane, and he also wore this with him. Because he wore it as a pilot.
Yeah, yeah. And the story of the pilots is in itself a fascinating one because, of course, the Air Force was not really in existence at the start of World War II. It was part of the Army. So we didn't really have this corps of pilots. And they were being quickly pulled from civilian life, almost like the GIs were. And commercial air travel was in a very rudimentary at a very rudimentary stage in those days. So it wasn't as if there was this great pool of resources to draw from. So, the flip side of that is these flyers were really, really skilled, pilots, some of these guys were barnstormers. Some of these guys had been flying, mail planes through the Midwest and so these were guys who, learned by the seat of their pants and therefore were able to adapt very quickly to the kinds of, dangerous circumstances they encountered delivering paratroopers.
Yeah, they're flying a great airplane, but a very slow airplane and very susceptible to flak. And they're flying through it and dropping folks as they were dropping folks and maybe crashing after, and then after that, they had gliders attached to them, some of them, during the initial phase of the airborne exercise.
Yeah, there was a guy I wrote about who passed away about a year ago, and he's actually the final chapter of the book focuses on him, and he was an artillery lieutenant who was among the 10,000, 14,000 troops that were encircled at Bastogne. And anyone familiar with that, in this case, there was this very small group of paratroopers. Literally, I think it was two sticks. I think there were 13 men in total who had to jump into the center of this. If you picture a donut, and the outside of the donut is 40,000 German troops and artillery, and in the center of it is this little city, this little rail hub of Bastogne, where our troops were encircled, starving, injured, out of medicine, out of all supplies. I mean, blankets, ammunition. They were just short of everything, and we had food. And so this great this tremendous airdrop was executed. But before it could happen, again, they had to, this small group of Pathfinders had to jump in. And in their case, they just threw smoke grenades to let the pilots know if it was a go or not, because they didn't know how close the German troops were to the drop zone. Anyway, there was
Battle of the Bulge, right? I mean, Bastogne was Battle of the Bulge.
That was Battle of the Bulge, exactly.
And it was in the winter. It was darn cold.
Yeah. I lost my train of thought, but so there was this one guy who was a first lieutenant with an artillery unit, and he was actually on the ground as the crates of supplies were dropped by parachute, and they were color coded so that they knew whether to load them onto trucks that would bring them to areas where there are wounded men or where they needed, you know, whether they needed medicine, whether they needed ammunition. And he was 90 years old when I met him, and I was actually doing a talk on about the book, and he said to me that the bravest men he'd ever seen were the pilot and the co-pilot of one particular C-47 that was on fire. And they were going down, and even as they went down, the co-pilot was tossing crates into the air to get it to our troops, knowing that they were goners. And he saw that plane go down,
right?
And he remembered that above and beyond all else. I would love to write a book about just those men, because that's really an overlooked story of the war.
Yeah, there's a lot of those that are those hidden gems. Yeah, you read about Patton and Bradley and Montgomery and all this stuff, but there's these little gems of people that done monumental or unbelievable thing.
Yeah.
And adversity. So what other, you write other genres too, though. You just don't write historical fiction or historical. But you write, you know, the thriller, suspense. What do you like writing the best?
It's a tough one. I write in just about every genre. And one of the things that I actually threw up on Amazon. Hopefully people don't throw up when they read it. But one of the things I put up on Amazon, as far as my author's bio, was that genre has never been important to me, even when I was very young, even when I was a kid and read everything. And what was more important was story and character. And I think that that's something that's just stuck with me my entire life. So although there might be different times of my life where I become more interested in reading, I might have read when I was younger, I might have read a lot of fantasy and science fiction. I might have then read a lot of mysteries. It's always really been more about the writer and the way something is written than what it's about. And that's something that has served me well throughout my career, because at different times when I've sort of had to move from one particular genre to another, sometimes by necessity, I've been able to be light on my feet and very nimble in terms of changing. And initially it's funny, because, you know, you think you might have an opportunity to write in a particular genre that's not one you're crazy about or one that's even familiar to you. But, if you've developed certain skills, you can bring them to the project. And ultimately what I found is that I end up liking whatever it is. I get into whatever it is I'm writing. So I don't really have a favorite. I'm probably best known for writing, you know, what they call techno thrillers or military thrillers or action thrillers. And I really enjoy that. But I also, I like writing mysteries as well. So it's really whatever I'm doing at the moment is kind of my favorite thing.
What you like? Yeah, I've written, you know, thriller, suspense, technos, them like yours, but then I just finished my World War I historical fiction.
Yeah, I'd seen that actually,
and so I'm pretty psyched about it. It's a great story. I've never seen a story like it.
Done with World War I.
No, and this is about an unknown soldier and his diary.
Did you find it difficult to research in terms of nuts and bolts?
Yeah, man, I read the first World War One book, a history of it, the history of the 1st Infantry Division. It's from 1925. So that and some articles and some other books for uniforms and things, you know, kind of put them all together and then wrote the diary of the soldier based on some of the events going on in World War One.
Mm-hmm. One of the hardest books that for me was I wrote a book called Civil War Commando, and it was what I found was having knowledge of the Civil War was one thing, but it was kind of the minutiae. It's like the stuff like, you know, you're writing about what they're putting in a cannon when they run out of ammo, and it's like, well, I don't know what it is. So you have to research that, or even a simple scene like, the main character in the story is, a guy named William Cushing, who became a naval officer. I'm thinking right now of a scene in which he went from, I think, Annapolis to New York to meet his brother by rail. Mm-hmm. His brother was at West Point. And it suddenly dawns on me that I have no clue what the connections would have been. And I have no clue. I'm very, when he gets into a train, what did those trains look like? What was it? If I'm writing a scene with him and he's just sort of sitting back and staring out the window, what was he seeing? And those are the things that I found were not hard to research, but it was constant stop and go for me. When I would try to really flesh the scene out like that.
Yeah, the big thing for me was making sure in World War I, they didn't have medics. They were called stretcher bearers.
There you go. Yeah.
You got to use stretcher bearers instead of medics. And then, when did the BAR come out? Yeah. When did they use it in World War I?
So, right.
Because people go there and say, well, that's not right.
You'll get one thing wrong. You'll get like if you get and you I don't know how many pages your book is, but let's say it's 400 pages, that it'll be the greatest story. It'll be gripping. And then you'll go on Amazon. You even know, I see why you're nodding. So you know where I'm heading. You'll go on Amazon and somebody will write, you know, one star. He got this one term. He got the stretcher bearer thing wrong. Otherwise great book, but have to give it one star.
You know? Yeah.
And it kills you.
I'm talking to a guy that does, I know. He writes historical fiction. And he has to make sure he has his rivet numbers in the airplane right, because somebody will say that's not the number of rivets in the airplane.
Oh, you'll get killed for it all the time, every single time. And there'll always be the person who knows exactly how many rivets were in there. There's always somebody out there who in fact might even be lying.
But he wrote a review.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, hopefully my story's so captivating that will take away from any of the idiosyncrasies I put in there.
Well, that's all
fiction.
We can all admire it and hope and pray.
Exactly, exactly. So what are you working on now?
Well, I just completed talking about historical fiction, I just completed a lengthy proposal for a World War II era historical fiction. It's actually set entirely in the United States, in the home front, and it takes place in Maine and New York. Not coincidentally, my two bases of operation, and it's all based on some very really really fascinating information that I picked up over the year as to things that occurred in both states and actually throughout New England. So I just completed that, and hopefully we go somewhere with that. And there's a couple of other things that I'm sort of getting started on in the meantime, but kind of top secret as of yet. What's interesting about the home front thing.
Hold on, everybody, don't listen.
But I'll give a wing that, most people don't know that at one point we had tens of thousands of German prisoners on American soil during World War II. And depending on what state they were in, and they were all throughout, because what had happened was local governments lobbied for them to come to the United States because we had a shortage of manpower on the farms, yep. in the paper mills, in factories. All the boys were off to war. So in order to fill that void, when in Europe, there were all these German prisoners and nobody knew what to do with them. They didn't want them too close to the lot, to the front lines. They finally came upon the solution. Well, you know, let's send them to the United States. And they'd have to volunteer because the Geneva Convention prohibits forced labor, obviously. So, you know, they would volunteer to go if they wanted. And clearly it was preferable to being stuck in a POW camp in Britain or France. So they came here. They were able to work on farms. And in many areas, they were given tremendous, tremendous freedom. And that varied from state to state and camp to camp. Here in Maine, there were three POW camps, all in the northern part of the state, right on the border with Canada. And they worked for the paper mills. One thing I learned in doing this story is that the Maine paper mills were essential to the war effort. Because the paper that came from the manufacturers here were making punch cards, and punch cards were essential for records keeping in world, mm-hmm. throughout all our armed forces in World War II. So if we had a shortage of manpower, that was a problem. They were also picking potatoes, and they were also harvesting ice. And, so there was a lot of interesting stuff. Ice harvest was big in Maine up until the 1950s, because not everybody had refrigeration. So they chopped these big...
And a lot of them could stay here when they were done, right?
Yeah, that's...
They could stay... There's a community that's built around that.
Yeah. That's great that you bring that up. How I found out about that was before I moved to Maine, I was coming up here on a visit from New York, and there was some eclipse was happening during that time. So... I pulled the car over to a little park area along the shore to catch the eclipse on my way to where I was going. And, I start talking to this older man who's a park ranger, and he's got a German accent. And my mother and grandmother were from Austria. So I recognized the accent right away, and we started talking. Mm-hmm. And, he in fact starts telling me, I was a prisoner. I was a POW here in Maine when I was young. This goes back. It's like 25 years ago, and I knew nothing about any of this stuff. So that led to a conversation that ultimately led me to researching the whole thing. So it's, but a lot of them who did go back home to Germany came back because they'd met girls over here, and you know, they tied the knot. They fell in love over here.
Right.
So it's really,
there's a lot. There's one. I live in north of Dallas, and there's one World War II out close to here, or towards Princeton.
Some of them, like here in Aroostook County, is potato country here, really, really close to Canada. And there's one camp there. I think it was the biggest one, and a lot of it's still has been preserved. I haven't yet gone up there, but I'm going to go up there. Now that the weather's getting better, because you know it's pretty, pretty cold in northern Maine during the winter.
That's why they put the Germans there, was just like Germany.
It's like Bavaria. Yeah.
Home sweet home.
Yeah,
my wife's German. No,
There was one group, in fact, in one of the camps that were complaining that they couldn't get good bread, because they're used to, like, you know, Germany, they get the greatest bread. So eventually they were allowed to build their own stone oven on the premises and bake their own bread, which probably was pretty darn good. A lot better than they would have been getting in a POW camp in London, or not London, but in England.
Oh yeah, of course. So French folks, don't get mad because you said German bread's the best. German bread is very good.
It is quite good. No, no, don't get mad at me. French is good. French is Italian is great.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's all good.
German is good too. We love them all.
So what did you find the most challenging about marketing your book? Or does your publisher do that more for you than anybody?
The most challenging part was I don't want to get in trouble, but leaving it to the publishers, which they just can't do it effectively in the market we have nowadays. There's too much competition and their resources are spread too thin. So I found a solution in hiring a publicist. Her name is Liz Malone. And I mentioned her because she's utterly fantastic and really.
I'm actually going to check her out. As a matter of fact, I want to talk to her.
I will. I don't want to I don't want to talk for the next 20 minutes. But what I will say is that since I started working with Liz about a year ago, I immediately came to understand the absolute necessity of having your own publicist, and also what it's done for me is lift this huge weight off my shoulders. I was always stressing over what was not being done and writing emails to my agent, who was writing emails to the publisher, and they do what they can. But again, it's they just don't have the physical resources, the manpower, mm-hmm. to deal with the number of books that are coming out and trying to sort of place them with different areas in which they can be promoted. So, mm-hmm. yeah, that's the most difficult. And yet, I really found a solution. So I don't even think about it anymore. I just bug Liz, so she's got to deal with the headaches.
She's young.
Well, right, exactly. A lot younger than I am.
Yeah, I've reached out. Matter of fact, I've talked to her regarding the interviews and stuff. So, I'm into this book, folks. If you're interested in World War II, D-Day, Bastogne, Battle of the Bulge, paratrooping. When you're an airborne soldier or just tenacity, your great book.
Do we have another minute? Because one thing I'd like to say.
Yeah.
Yes. When I wrote it, I had several goals in mind, but one of them was to bring the reader right into the action. I had written a novel a number of years before in which I did the same thing. I just thought I'm starting off in the middle of a car chase that ran 40 pages, and it just had all, I didn't know what was going to happen. I just had all kinds of crashes and everything. And when I did this book, I had just written another World War II history book called Codename Caesar, which was very heavy in exposition. And there's just a lot of data that I had to dump on the reader. So with this one, I very deliberately said, I want to be boots on the ground from the very beginning and have the reader experience what it's like to be jumping from the plane and landing on the ground and then immediately having to execute the mission. And so that was what I tried very hard to capture in the book. So we actually begin with the first paratroop drop, and within minutes they're on the ground. And I was that part of the book I was really happy with.
Yeah, in my World War I actually put the person in all of it, from the training aspect of it to the combat, the effects of being a soldier to an NCO, leadership, everything in it. So I wanted to make him really engulfed in it. But it's read. Yeah, yeah. But a father and son find the old diary in a Bible 100 years later. And they read it and they retrace the steps of the soldier.
Really interesting.
All the way to Arlington.
Wow.
National Cemetery.
Wow.
So, yeah, something different. Yeah. Well, great. So what advice would you give any fledgling author or any other author out there?
the only piece of advice I ever really give is just keep, if you want to write, you've got to do it. You've got to devote a certain amount of time to it on a regular basis.
Yes.
And we all deal with life, so it's difficult. But that's why the thing is, don't think, well, okay, I want to write every day for 3 hours. Well, most of us, especially starting out, when if we have jobs and other responsibilities, we can't do it. So be honest and realistic with yourself. And if that's a half an hour every 2 days, it's like learning to play a musical instrument. It's like being it's like anything you do. It's be fair to yourself and think, okay, I can give it 15 minutes a day. I can give it a half an hour a day. Don't worry what you end up turning out that day, but get used to just sitting down and spending that time doing it. And eventually you'll find a groove or a rhythm. And I think it's like anything else, you know, it's, I always use the baseball analogy, which is if you're going to be a great baseball player, you have to do your reps. You have to go to batting practice. If you bench a baseball player for 3 days, they're automatically off their rhythm. And it doesn't matter. It can be the greatest hitter in the world, but he then needs to take a few days to get back on it. When a guy's on the injured list, same thing. That's the way it is with writing. You have to just keep doing it or you're going to get off your rhythm. And that's like the best advice I can give on a very practical, pragmatic level.
I would agree 100% with you. Well, Jerome, again, I'm really digging this book. Big Tom Clancy fan too. So I wish you the best and I can't wait for your next endeavor that we just kind of discussed. It's a secret. Nobody talk about it.
Top secret.
Nobody share.
Don't even say you saw this podcast.
That's right. He's a vow.
All right. It was great talking to you, Trev.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.